Call this meeting of the Early Childhood and Family Supports Committee to order for Tuesday, May 2nd, 2017. I appreciate colleagues your being here given the starts and stops we're having on the floor. And I'm going to open an informational hearing on the Oregon Child Care Market Study. Please, Dr. Weber.
Make your way through the crowd.
Yeah, that's right.
Good afternoon, Chairman Lively and members of the committee. I'm Bobby Weber, Roberta Weber, from Oregon State University. And I'll be sharing with you findings from my research. These are not the position of Oregon State University. They're from the work I've done. So I'm responding. As I understand it, the concern is how the way the system works and what the impact is having on rural providers. But actually, I would say it's any provider in a low-wage community.
Right.
And so that's how I have framed my presentation, is trying to address what we know and don't know about that question. I will say I completely concur in the problem. The differences, the inequalities in the child care system are something we should all be concerned about, I think. So what I thought would make the most sense is to start with a big picture, the system and the types of public investment, so that as we move through, you've got pieces to hang things on to. Then go into the Child Care and Development Fund, which is one of the two major federal investments in child care, its history and how what they tell us about setting rates. And then going even more narrower to our program in Oregon and what are some of the relevant findings from the Market Pride study and other work we've done. And then get to the heart of the matter. What are the challenges of using ERDC to improve provider income and strategies for improving the child care in general in low-wage communities? So the system, I think, as when I was here before, we talked a little bit about this, so it's kind of a review. This, it's a market system. So I think the closest is housing. Health, years ago, I used to use the analogy of the healthcare system in America, but with what we've done to the healthcare system, housing is now a better comparison. It's really driven primarily by market forces, and it's interesting that childcare prices and housing prices are correlated at 0.85. And not only in Oregon, but I think we did that in 5 or 7 states, and they were highly correlated in every state. I don't think that means that housing drives child care prices. I think there's some outside factor that drives both of them. But the important thing to get on this slide is parents are the funder of this system, about 70%. And when you look at the public investment, state and federal, it's important to know that 80% of that is in tax credits. So the public investment directly into programs is very, very, very small. Parents actually control a tax credit, so that's an important thing. What this is going to mean and becomes relevant as we go on is what parents are able and willing to pay drives what happens in a community in terms of the child care system it has, both how much it has and the quality of it and the parents. So I would say if we were going to be talking about, I think we are going to be talking about inequities, this is core. the relationship between the income of the community and the child care system they have is so interlocked because of it being a market system. So.
And so based on that, though, those figures you're giving us, are those actual, whether they're credits or what they are, actual dollars invested, or those estimate what they would be, but depending on the uptake on those credits, would not that substantially change?
No, when this study, it was done by economists at OSU and using input-output modeling. I think they actually got, but I'd have to go back and ask the researchers.
Thank you.
So I'm not really positive. I thought they actually got revenue.
Got the actual.
But I don't know for sure. If that's important, I'd be happy to ask. The researcher is still there.
Okay.
Mallory Ray. So this sounds a little egghead, but please stick with me. It's really important.
Egghead.
That when government invests in early childhood, there's two predominant ways, demand-based and supply-based. Demand-based means I give the parent money or access to money in the case of a subsidy, and that parent uses that money however they want to in terms of what child care they are, what provider they're going to choose, or in a tax credit, they don't even have to spend it on child care. I mean, it's they get it, and it's so parents are in the driver's seat. These two ways of funding aren't one good and one bad. They're just different. And so one of the things about this one is the amount of power it gives to parents. And it's not controlling the family in any way. Supply-based funding, the two big examples are Head Start, the major supply-based funding in the United States and in Oregon, and Preschool Promise, Early Head Start. These are all supply-based. Here, the parent is not the person who gets the money. The provider, a payment is made via a contract with a provider, and then in all these cases, it's free to the parent, and so then the parent gets the assistant, but they don't really have complete choice. If this provider is free and this one costs me $1,000, that's not really a free choice. And so that's why I'm saying it's not, they're different. In my own personal opinion, it would be that they are, that if from a policy sense, we use both, and we think about in what instances does this strategy make the most sense, and in what instances does this make the most sense. And this is going to come up later, because if you want to target money, a supply-based system is far more effective at doing what you want it to do. And neither of these types of funding are the people who are employees of the state. They're not public employees. It's all done either indirectly through a subsidy, and the provider is a business, maybe a nonprofit, but they're a business of some kind, and they receive money from the state on behalf of a family. Or they get a contract in supply base with the state, but the employees are still employees of the nonprofit or the for-profit organization. Okay? Was this too confusing?
Oh, no, yes. Well, thank you, Chair Lively. The ERDC is the early human services, or is that not in one of these categories?
ERDC is the child care subsidy program, and I just used it more broadly, a broader term than ERDC, but any place I use child care subsidy, I could say ERDC. We also use TANF dollars in as well as employment-related daycare, and so I tend to use the broader term. But so it's a demand-based way of funding early child care.
Okay, so that's under the category of the, like you said, parents kind of get a select, but the state pays those child care providers directly.
Yes, the parent is eligible for the subsidy, gets the voucher, basically, mm-hmm. and then chooses the provider of their choice, and then that provider bills the state. And so the check goes to the provider, but only if the parent has selected that provider.
So they bill them for the amount of the voucher, right?
They bill this, you know, can you
so
hold on
to
that?
I'm getting at the
that?
Parent pays the copay here.
The parent pays the copay, and the state pays up to the maximum, but I'm going to deal with this again, so maybe I'll say it here and then we'll hit it again.
Okay.
The provider may only charge what they charge private pay parents. So if the voucher has a maximum reimbursement of $1,000, but I only charge parents in my community $500 because that's all the market will bear, I may only charge the state $500. The voucher isn't worth a dollar amount. The voucher allows the provider to charge using their own rates that they charge other families.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
But in what cases do the child care providers charge more than the voucher?
They are limited to the maximum of the payment rate. So let's say I charge parents $1,500, but the maximum is $1,000. I can try and get that $500 from those low-income parents, but I'm not going to get it from the state.
So again, it still says parents pay the copay. So in that case of the voucher of ERDC, there's really no copay.
No, the parent has a copay. There's a table. They pay a copay, and then we call the difference between the maximum that the state will pay and what the provider charges, the differential. I don't know. I mean, that's just jargon to help us talk about it. A parent could have to pay both a copay and a differential.
So in ERDC, they pay a copay to the state? Is that what you're saying?
No, they pay it to the provider. Right. So let's say the provider was supposed to get their usual pay was $1,000, and the parent's copay was $250. Then they can only bill $750 to the state because the copay gets subtracted out of what the state pays.
Thank you.
Okay. Makes sense. Okay, I just want to say, because Oregon's paying at the 75th percentile, that means we're covering 75% of providers' rates. We don't have that many with a differential, right? Only that little piece at the top. Does that make sense? Okay. In case I don't have that later, we're one of only a few states. That's what the federal government is trying to get states to do, has been trying to get the states to do since the late 80s, but it's not what they're doing. So now I'm going to talk about the federal program, CCDF, is what we call Child Care and Development Fund. Actually, the federal government investing in child care assistance began in the late 80s, and had a lot of different names, and there were a lot of little tiny funding streams by which the federal government was giving child care assistance. And then in 96, as a part of welfare reform, the federal government combined all the programs, all these different subsidy programs, into the Child Care and Development Fund, and that is the major child care funding in the United States. As I said, this is a demand-based approach to assistance. The primary goal, and hold on to this is really important on the subject we're talking about, it's to provide eligible families access to the market in their community. It was never intended to support providers. It was totally focused on giving parents access to care in their community. Over the last 10 years, I'd say. The Office of Child Care that administers this program has become increasingly concerned about the kinds of inequities that are raising this conversation, because in a market system, there are people who are living where the market is inequitable. And when the market's inequitable, then providers are not treated fairly in those communities. And so there have been attempts to try and tweak the system as much as possible in order to be able to address, and we're going to talk about some of those. But price is the major barrier to accessing child care in the United States. I mean, there's just nothing comes close to what price does to keep people out of child care. And as I said, states are encouraged to pay a high enough rate so that parents can access 75% of the care in their community, so that each parent has access. But one of the things is the federal government also sets aside a percentage of child care and development funds to support quality. And so those funds are not at all tied to being demand-based. The state has a lot of flexibility in how it invests its quality dollars.
Okay, Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Chair Lively. So over a period of time, couldn't a market-based system really be analogous to a price-fixing system? Because if they have to do it at this rate and they can't afford to charge them more, and they do it at that rate, the market rate the next year, the market rate the next year, you end up kind of locking that in time.
Well, we're going to address that question directly, but the quick answer is the prices of child care in a community are driven what the parents who live in that community are willing and able to pay. They're not. How quickly are we going to get to this? Can you hold on to it?
Sure.
It's really important,
yep.
And I'm going to walk
yep.
through it. Yeah. So let's go into rate setting, because this is really a key part of this conversation. So there in the federal rule, which was just revised in 2016, there it continues to be this market-based system with the primary goal of access for parents, but and it requires states to complete a study that differentiates by age of child, type of care, and geography, by community, and to use those findings in setting rates. And the 2016 rule is much stronger in that states are going to have to show what kind of study they did, whether it was valid, and how they used it in rate setting. So market price studies are named, and they're called micro rate studies, but it's more accurate, really, to call it a price study, so we call it a price study. They're named, and they're the only reliable and cost-effective method for differentiating by age, type of care, and geography. And the states are, though, in this new rule, encouraged to consider costs. So I think that there's now, that when I was saying that over the last 10 years, there's been this effort to try and be more fair to providers, that that's what this is, the way it came out in the rule. Payment rates set the maximum. We already talked about that. They don't set what the provider charges. It sets what the maximum they can pay. And there's a federal principle. It's named in the rule. It's named in all federal. It covers all federal funding, that providers can only charge the state what they charge for private pay parents. But what they did in the 2016 rule is said, unless they can show they're providing higher quality. So a friend of mine said, they think the OMB missed this and let it go through. But it means that it gives us this little loophole that if the provider is meeting a level of quality, we can pay them more than they're charging other parents. Is that making sense? Ask questions, because this is really key. It's a new part of the subsidy program.
So is that what helped to develop in the ERDC, the three different zones? And within
those zones
you've got four different categories.
We're going to look at the maps.
Certifications.
Yeah, no. I'm going to show you the maps. The maps are a reflection of what the providers are charging. They're not set. They're not set by deciding anything. They're set by studying what are providers actually doing in their community, and then these clusters. But I'm going to show them to you. The Oregon. Please.
Go ahead. Thank you. Because I'm guessing. Because I understand Representative Hayden's concerns. It's that if you're constantly giving a lower level because that's what the market says, then that continues to be the pattern, which keeps everyone else down, and it hurts. And I'm guessing that part of the problem is if you were to increase it, if we had a state law that allowed you to increase it to start closing that gap, would it be a problem for the other people out there trying to compete? And if they lost their ERDC recipients, they'd be stuck at this higher level, and then they would be at a disadvantage? Like, what is the thinking in...
We're going to go actually through it,
okay.
But...
All right. Well, I'll hold it to the end, but I know that that's what he's getting at.
ERDC represents only 8% of the paid slots in Oregon.
Eight?
It does. Eight. They're not controlled. Prices are not being controlled by ERDC. It's the flip. The
market is
the market ERDC. Is controlling is in because of the requirement to do a study and to use it to inform. That drives rates, but the direction is the provider prices shape the rate.
Right.
Not that the rates shape the prices. But I'm going to show you in a lot more detail. So now ERDC, 57% federal, 43% state, almost all CCDF funds. Here, 18% of eligible children, so of the large number that we could serve, even using our own rules, we only reach 18. But these children represent only 8% of the slots that are filled with paid child care. Mm. That's why they can't drive the market. They're too small. We were part of a study, I don't know, 10 years ago or so, where we looked at three states to ask the question of, could the payment rates actually drive prices, or is it? And in California, where they were paying over 100% of the market rate, we found a very, very, very small effect on prices. And in other states, we didn't. So the providers eligible to participate in ERDC are all legally operating providers. So in Oregon, you don't have to be regulated, although now you have to be monitored. That's kind of a fine line because of the new federal rule. They're selected by parents, and I'm going to show you, but the majority of them, with the exception of large family child care homes, they don't care for a child on subsidy. So I'm going to give you the numbers, and I hope, tables are hard. But the percent of providers by type of care, so center, small home base, large home base, with at least one child on the subsidy program and broken out by the degree of urbanicity, you see those large home based, but only in micropolitan areas are over half of them caring for at least one child on the subsidy program. And otherwise, it's ranging well below 50%. So then you ask, how about those providers who have at least one child, are they filling their program with children from the subsidy program? And no.
No.
They're not. So that's good. In from a policy sense, what it means is we are not segregating our low-income children into a limited number of programs. They are in programs with kids who aren't on the subsidy for, you know, almost always.
Well, it's good in that perspective, but the point of it is we're only serving such a small percentage of those that are eligible. I mean, if we were serving a much higher percentage, those figures might change.
Okay.
Because if you're telling me we have 18% of the eligible population that are being served.
Yeah, and they represent 8% of the 8%
of
the children who are in care.
So if that 18% were 50% or 60%, that's what I'm saying.
We have a different picture.
Yeah. Okay. That's just what I want to make. There is.
Yes.
I mean, I can appreciate some of this based on such a small number of being served. But
right.
That's not the whole story.
No. Okay. No. So, yeah. So what we have is a very small percent of the slots filled with children on subsidy. We have a less than half of the providers who care for even one child. And amongst those who care for even one child, it's predominantly less than half of their kids and far less than half, depending where you are.
Where is 100%? Those are 30, like... doesn't add up to 100%, so I'm just trying to
understand.
Oh, no. These
are, they don't add that way. I see what you're trying to do. You can't,
this
wasn't set up to, it's 33% of the centers in rural area have at least one child on a subsidy. But the 100% is all centers in the rural community.
Right.
That makes,
I get it. 33%. Yeah.
By the way, we are working at trying to find a better way to tell this story because we know it's confusing. But, okay, so 26% of small home-based providers in rural communities have at least one child.
At least one child.
Right, okay.
And of those 26% who have at least one child, they fill about 24% of their slots with kids on subsidy.
So I think the important point is 8% of the population that is eligible fills 24% of the slot.
No.
No, because 24% of all the small home-based out there have a child. Percent of desired capacity.
No, 26% of small-based
right.
have
no,
at least one child.
And if
right.
they have at least
4%.
One, we put them into the calculator. We know their capacity. We know how many child care slots that provider has. And we know at a point in time how many kids on subsidy they're caring for. So it's, let's... Too bad we don't have a 25% to make the math easy. But, you know, small home-based provider typically around six kids, and 24% of six kids would be on the subsidy program if she had at least one child on the subsidy program. But three-quarters of them have none.
Except that's only 8% of the population that's eligible.
18%. This stuff is just too hard, isn't it?
Yeah.
18% of the kids are eligible. 8% of the slots. So if you took every provider and all the slots they have, 8% of them are filled with a child on subsidy.
ERDC.
So they're spread out
all over the place.
That's not ERDC. That's anything. That's not just ERDC. That's anything.
No, they're ERDC. On ERDC. So if you take the slots that are for all children in Oregon,
right?
All of them,
right?
8% of them are filled with a child who's being helped by the subsidy program.
Okay. The ERDC only, or ERDC and anything else?
They probably
like Portland ERDC. Children's Levy.
I think most children on the subsidy are not getting other help.
Okay.
I mean, there's a few instances in which they're Head Start and ERDC or something,
right.
But.
Okay.
I just apologize that this stuff is so hard.
Just keep going. I'm sure we'll get it.
Okay. So then the price study, we've been doing it every 2 years since 1990. And we actually, back in around 2004 to 2009, did a national study on the validity of market rate studies. It was a national study. We worked with a lot of states. And our method proved to be highly valid. So this is, and that study is the rule quotes it over and over and over as the way states need to do market price studies. So it's a valid study. We've been doing it every 2 years. Prices vary by the age of child. Infant care is the most expensive type of care. Centers are far more expensive than home-based care, especially small home-based care. And geography. Metropolitan areas are more expensive than micropolitan or especially than rural. And child care prices, I'll just show you, they go up faster than inflation. These are inflation-adjusted tables, so you can see that rise is, you take whatever inflation we had going, this is an addition. For reasons that are probably related to the same reason that housing prices are so complicated in Oregon, child care prices keep rising, except if you're a small home-based provider. And they really are not doing well financially.
Right.
And you can see the difference.
Just make one more. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm actually really astounded that between 2008 and 2010, it would have gone up because so many people lost jobs.
I know. Isn't it amazing?
They were pulling them out of childcare.
And everybody predicted that we were going to lose programs. We didn't. It stayed stable. The rate of growth stopped. I think it's kind of, in a way, this is anecdotal. I don't have a study to back me up. In a way, the only way providers survived the recession was to raise prices because they had a smaller number of children and they had to reduce classroom size. So they didn't go out of business, but they reduced the number and they increased the price. But the pricing is, I'm way beyond my capacity to really explain all the forces in prices.
Thank you, Chair. One of the concerns I have is kind of in back in my own district. I live in, you know, Southwest Portland, Beaverton area, and it's the land of Nike and Intel and all the high-tech industries, and there's people pouring in for really good-paying jobs, and people are demanding child care, and they can't even find it. For them, it isn't even so much how much it costs, but is it even available. I'm wondering how that affects market rate, because it's like any other product, you know, supply and demand, and people, these are good-paying jobs, and they'll just pay more and more and more, and so it's squeezing out other more modest income people in the area that can't afford to pay these exorbitant prices. And what can we do about that in those areas where there's such increased demand?
Since America has chosen a market system, we have the tools, the kind you're considering with housing, to try and influence the market. Subsidies to help people open more programs. I mean, those kind. There are things that can be done, but the basic dilemma is America has chosen a private market system, and so market forces cause these problems. A huge percentage of middle America has been cut out of the child care system entirely. Can't even consider using it. They hope they have a grandmother.
Yeah. One thing that I've heard people telling me is that they are driving their children long distances to a different part of town because the child care is more affordable there. And it's like nuts. It's stressful enough to be a young parent with kids and then having to drive them all over Kingdom Come to get to. So I don't know if there's anything we can do to sort of even that out somehow.
There are, but they are in the realm of the kinds of things that are going to shape the market.
Right. Yeah.
We could give more subsidies, but we'd have to increase the income level to help the families you're talking about, because We'd have to let people go up to 250-300% of poverty and still be eligible. Yeah. There are things we can do, but they're not cheap.
So we're going to have to go back onto the floor, so we'll have to...
Okay. Let me just... I'll just tell you the story really quickly. Right. The maps, the child care... There's the rate map. What happened to the child care map? I must have gone too fast. If you... Here's the map that you're talking about, Representative Hayden. This is the child care map. And the red is the most expensive. See it right there in West Portland. Orange is next. See it? It's down the valley. Yellow, see it? It's spotted around the state. And blue is the balance of state. Now look at the minimum wage map. You get pretty much the same picture, and I'll did a comparison. 31 of the 36 counties are clustered the same way in both maps. The counties, there was a little bit of those five, some went with a high, some went with a low, but basically the two maps are telling the same story.
Not exactly.
So revenue problems faced by providers, we've really talked about these, I think. The cost of providing care in rural and urban communities does differ somewhat, but although many costs, housing and wages are lower, mm-hmm. There are other costs that are the same wherever you live in Oregon. And so the result is that although child care costs twice as much in West Portland as it does in rural Oregon, not the same thing with cost. It doesn't cost twice as much in Portland. It's this market, the way the market systems.
Okay, thank you, Chair Lively. Okay, so I haven't ever been, I'm not a huge advocate of a market system, but what's not being presented here, in my mind, is the group A, B, and C.
You want to go back to it? To the map?
You have the no. I'm talking about the actual numbers. I don't see those anywhere on the slide. So I have them for you. Group A, an infant in Group A, which of course is your red category, gets a subsidy of $1,130 for that. If you go to the blue, Group C, if they can have the same quality, which is the licensed rate maximums, in Group C, they can get up to, let me get that, $586 for the same quality of care. But the reality in those Group Cs, how many of these maximum rates is there, and so they're probably more likely to use a standard rate. So the reality of the blue is getting $440 and the A is getting $1,130 for the same infant. That's my beef with the system.
But your beef is with the market. That is what parents are willing to pay in those communities. Those numbers come from an actual study of what providers are charging, and it's that different.
That'd be $2,000.
Yeah, but you're using...
The law requires us to set rates by what happens. So let's say we set all the rate. We did one rate, and we said, we're going to take an average, and we're going to pay it the same. You better hope that you live in the blue, because you're not even going to... A subsidy is not going to be worth anything in the yellow and the red and the orange. Because this
program is giving parents access
to the care in their community. Those prices that you're quoting because they're reflected in the rate schedule are because that's what providers in that part of the state are charging parents. Right. It's not because of where we set the rates.
And they're charging those rates because they've been locked into this system for 10 years.
The reason they're not charging what parents in Portland charge is because if they did, nobody would come.
Right.
Nobody would use their service. I worked in the field for years, and I remember a provider in Lebanon increased her prices 25% and 25 cents an hour, and she lost half of her families. It's in the blue area, they are very price sensitive. And even if we set the rate in the blue areas at the same as we set it in Portland, they can only charge what they charge the parents in private. Their community. They couldn't charge the state that rate.
But still under the market rate, my understanding is the state has the ability, to use standard rates, enhanced rates, wouldn't necessarily have to have that third higher tier.
I think we're mixing up two things. Enhanced rates, there's the geography of how prices, and that's we set the rates. But then in a completely different thing, and let me go, because we need to get to solutions. And it deals with what you're talking about.
Excuse me. I have a question to go back
I'm
to
sorry.
The previous slide, if you would.
You want to go back to the map?
I do, yeah. why is the... is there an outline of unpopulated area, no data along the Oregon coast?
I'll have to get back to you. We give our data. We get it from all the providers, and we give our data to DHS, and we get a map back. But it's not because we don't have providers along the coast. We get all the providers. So we didn't exclude them. I'll find out about the map. I don't know why the data looks like that and when it gets a map. But we have providers. We do the entire universe of providers, regulated providers. I think we've talked about all these issues, that this program was designed for parents, not for providers. It's to give them access. That means you have to know what care costs in their community to give them access to 75% of the care in that community. Okay, so then the second is that increasing the rates is not going to change the revenue overall for providers, because the majority don't participate,
right.
and when they do, it's a minority of their kids, and that only 8% of the slots are filled with ERDC. So if our commitment is to improving care in low-wage communities, ERDC is not a very good tool. It's just not designed to do it. And you get stuck with this really basic problem of it's fraud. If a provider charges the state a price higher than they charge the parents in their community, they've committed fraud. So those are the challenges of trying to fix this problem this way. The new rule allows the state to pay a higher payment rate if the service is of documented quality. So I want to go into solutions really in the last bit. The first is those enhanced rates that you're talking about. So the legislature passed enhanced rates. If you document your quality, we can pay you more. So if long as we keep that, then we can't. Then the next solution is use those quality dollars and community dollars, any money we can, to get those providers to a level of quality so that we can pay them, and that can be higher than the price that they charge other families. Do you see? So this is, are some of the things we're doing right now.
So I don't see it. Thank you, Chair Lively. I don't see it in here, but I would be interested to know, based on the enhanced rates of the groups A, B, and C, how many dollars go to group A, How many dollars go to Group B? How many dollars go to Group C?
Why don't we get back to you? I have no idea.
And
that's a DHS question.
And how much is that per member per month or per child per month?
Okay.
Good question.
Okay, we'll take that. I mean, it's DHS question, but it's not something that I have data to look at.
We can follow up on that as a committee question. Thank you.
Okay. So the two strategies that we've tested to help providers get to a higher level of quality so they can get the enhanced rate are focused networks. What's lovely about those is you can target them to rural communities or wherever you want. They're being targeted to high-need communities. Another one are these consortia that were done in southern and central Oregon, and they have been very effective in helping programs increase quality. Another strategy is to use supply-based mechanisms. Because of this concern about helping providers, the new rule talks specifically about encouraging states to write contracts. You're not tied to the market price if you're doing a contract, and you may use CCDF money for contracts. So, but and Oregon has a contracted slots program, but you have to be documented quality to get a contract. But that's another way. Expand the supply of free care, preschool promise. That can be in any kind of program. So expanding preschool promise and targeting these areas of low-wage families are ways to get more slots in there that families can use. And Head Start Child Care Partnerships, that it's a federal initiative, but it helps improve the quality. But federal Head Start dollars are used to help the provider meet the higher quality. Plus, they get direct Head Start payments. And I think that's it. You could say more, but there, it's not like we are powerless to do nothing, but there are challenges.
Well, the key, first, from my standpoint, is the number of slots. So the ability to have any early impact with such a low number is very limited. But secondly, since this is all market-based, then it goes back to this, the market factors are so different in rural versus urban in that.
Yes.
It doesn't mean, from an investment standpoint, we shouldn't still try to address it and do something different there. It only means that all of this is, you know, the market is the market. And if the market's bad, it'll just keep bad because we don't do anything different.
Right.
Representative Kenny Gow.
So I'm sympathetic to his concerns about this growing disparity that we have. And I'm wondering if, since it's market rate, why do you have this tiered system at all? Why not just say, this is, you know, this, you're going to provide subsidies to go to this child care. This child care center is basing their rates on what their local environment may provide. And in fact, if they're the only one around, it's true that they may be able to, you know, jack up their prices a little more. But that would be truly a market-based pricing system, unless you think all of the kids are going to get ERDC, and then it's distorted because, you know, they can take the state for a ride. But is that ever the case where you've got rural providers who are have 100% ERDC subsidized kids?
No, that's why I showed you that slide that was hard to read. I'm sorry, but we don't.
So it just seems to me like I do question the whole premise of a different tiered system. If childcare providers as a business are setting their rates based on their own kind of market forces, might be cost of housing. There may be some areas like Luno, Lincoln City, the cost of housing has gone skyrocket. Even if wages are staying low, that might be one of those discrepancy areas. Why not just have one rate that is allowable, and then it's going to vary community by community based on totally market forces for that community?
Well, first of all, you'd be violating the federal rule.
Well, no, because I'm not saying that ever you would pay somebody more.
No, the other part of the federal rule is that you'll use a study and it'll inform your rates, and that your rates are going to vary by age of child, type of care, and community. That's in the rule.
Yeah, you could, I think how you define community maybe is the part that you could question there.
So I don't think it would change much, though, because the provider is still going to be constrained by what the other parents can pay.
Right. No, I understand
even
that.
Even in Lincoln City.
Right.
So, and the thing we have to worry about is that poor parent who lives in Beaverton, mm-hmm. where prices are high. You set a rate that is equitable across the state, that parent is cut out of the program.
But I guess I would say you set one rate and it's on the high side, and then if the wherever area, Lincoln City or anywhere, if that child care provider is charging less because that's all that market would bear, then you can only, because you do it by 80% and they have to pick up 20% or however that is determined.
So you take the Portland rates and you set them for the entire state. Well, you'd be in violation of the federal rule, but I mean, states get to a lot of, this is a block grant. States have a lot of flexibility.
And then the rural area is only eligible to draw upon a higher rate if that's indeed what they're charging all the other kids. It's purely market-driven, based on community factors.
I would just say, from all my years of studying child care, you would really throw a kink in the work if you started.
That's what we want to do.
Hey, that's what we
started time. Telling parents and telling providers that they could charge up to $1,500.
But as you say, they're not going to do that if the other people in the community can't pay that.
I don't know.
Unless
Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
So big,
Milwaukee, Wisconsin had a huge problem because providers started working the system, uh-huh. and I mean, it isn't. These are small businesses, and I don't mean to impugn anybody, but Milwaukee was full of fraud, just God. Because people figured out how to work the system. So I don't know what would happen
ERDC,
if you did it.
So we're going to have to go back to the floor, but what does? So hopefully we can identify some other opportunities to have further these conversations, because you've raised some very valid reasons, and there's all kinds of, I mean, I really appreciate the information to understand better what has driven this and what that market study and all that means, but it doesn't help address, it doesn't solve the problem that we're trying to address.
I just want to see the cash flow.
I think trying to solve the child care problem with payment rates
isn't going to do
it's
it.
It's just not going to do it. Oh. You're just not going to. There's too few
I
kids.
I think that's right.
There's too few kids and too few providers involved that you're going to make much of a change in the system.
Thank you very much for
You're very welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you for
very welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for